The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, October 26, 2007, and this is episode number 101. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here this week, as always, to talk about MotoGP. So we got kind of a cool show today. Did a conference call with both Liam and Jules. First time we've done that. We talked for quite a bit just about some general all around various things going on in the world of MotoGP. We didn't concentrate too much on the Malaysian Grand Prix because, quite honestly, it was a little bit slow, a little bit of a snooze fest. So I'm going to talk about that one separately as well. We'll have a quick rundown race report on the Malaysian Grand Prix. It was interesting in its own way, but not the most exciting race of the season. And before we get to that, oh, and of course, we'll have a little bit of news and some other stuff and odds and ends and bits and pieces. Before we get to that, I do want to send a big shout out. Thank you very much to Keith Cunningham, Paul Dawson, and JJ Dewar for the second time. Thank you very much, JJ. All these guys were kind enough to donate to MotoGPOD. They went to the website at MotoGPOD.com and clicked on the link on the left-hand side and made a nice donation, and I really do appreciate that, guys. The funds do go towards helping the podcast out in one way or the other. I make jokes and stuff about how I buy beer with it and everything, and I'll admit I have in the past, but actually, no, most of the funds go to paying Skype bills and hosting and all of that sort of stuff. It's not just like some giant Bob slush fund of free money for beer and dates and whatever else or something like that. So if you're concerned at all, that's how it is. So moving on, let's talk a little bit about a couple things that happened in the news this past week and how this impacts our 2008 season. Both these stories came out on Thursday. We had Shinya Nakano signed a Gresini Honda deal. So Shinya Nakano is going to ride for Gresini Honda in 2008, making a sideways switch from the Konica Minolta Honda. He had a difficult maiden year on board the Darcy 212V, having switched factories from Kawasaki at the end of last season. Blah, blah, blah. And so he's going to be riding alongside Alex De Angelis on the Gresini Racing effort next year. And that's kind of cool. So that things evens things out there a little bit on Gresini. And then that also finalizes what's going on with Tony Elias, because this was all still a little bit up in the air. And Tony Elias has been confirmed as the second rider on the Dantin Ducati team. So he's going to be joining Sylvain Guattoli as the other rider for Dantin Ducati. So for the overall silly season, which is now pretty much over, shakeout, and here's what we've got going on, courtesy of the Kropotkin Thinks blog at MotoGP Matters. He's got a nice little list, so I didn't have to sort of make my own. And for Fiat Yamaha next year, it's going to be Valentino Rossi and Jorge Lorenzo, which is going to be an exciting matchup of teammates, and you just feel the love there. And it really looks like Rossi's going to be riding on Bridgestones, and Jorge Lorenzo is going to be riding on Michelins. We don't know that for sure yet, but that's pretty much the rumor mill currently and how things are going along, and so we'll kind of see how that one works out. Trois Yamaha is going to be Colin Edwards riding alongside James Toseland. We've heard that Colin's salary is being paid by the Yamaha factory, so that's kind of interesting. Now they're moving to Michelin's, getting off the Dunlops, so that's kind of good news for them in some ways. Bad news for Dunlop, that's for sure. Mauber Ducati, of course, is going to be Casey Stoner and Marco Melandri. That's going to be a formidable team, and they're going to be staying on the Bridgestones, and we'll see some really upfront action from both of those guys, because Marco's a heck of a good rider. He's been a bit of a random number generator this year, but by and large, I think he's got a lot of talent in. And I think that he'll do well on that Ducati. We'll have to see. Pramac Dantin Ducati is going to be Sylvain Guattoli and Tony Elias, like we said, also on Bridgestones. Repsol Honda, Danny Pedrosa and Nicky Hayden staying the same there and continuing on the Michelins. Gresini Honda is going to be Alex De Angelis and Shinya Nakano, like I just said. Probably riding on Bridgestones again next year. LCR Honda, it's got Randy DePugnier. He's going to be riding on Michelins. Then the what was formerly Konica Minolta Honda or Japanese International Racing or however you want to look at it, next year most likely going to be called Team Scott Honda, is Andre Dovizioso, who's bringing his basically his crew up from 250, and they'll be riding on Michelins. Kind of interesting stuff. Rizla Suzuki is going with Loris Caparossi and Christopher Mullen. Yeah, Kawasaki Racing will be John Hopkins and Anthony West. So Team KR is the one remaining team that we don't have a whole lot of firm, solid information of what's going on. According to Kropotkin thinks, he's got unknown, but probably at least one Roberts, which, yes, is a very, very safe bet. And then the rumor mill has it that it's going to either be possibly on Ilmor's or Ducati's. That's leading to a lot of speculation there, because if they go on Ducati's, it's likely to be an entire whole Ducati motorcycle. Is Ducati going to be willing to support three teams like that? I kind of doubt it. The possibility of the Ilmor engine in the Team KR chassis is probably more likely, but then they might be opening up a whole new can of worms as far as getting all of that package to work. And or who knows, there might be the hidden third or even fourth or fifth options that we have not yet heard about of what's going on there. But we definitely hope to see Team KR next year. I don't think, though, that we're going to know for absolute certain right up until the very last minute. That's pretty much how it was this year, and I think that's kind of establishing a pattern a little bit. So that kind of concludes our silly season silliness for this year. That's good stuff. Now, Jim Race from Ride On 2 sent me a link to a joke website, and I wanted to mention this, too. If you go to RC212V.com. You go to RC212V.com, and you're thinking, well, what's this? Is it like the official Honda white race site or something like that? No, this is, you know, sort of a joke. It's why does Honda hate its riders document, and Honda hates Hayden and Pedrosa, fix the bike, etc., etc. And there's some jokes and stuff in there. It unfortunately could be fleshed out a lot more as far as humor and whatnot, but it's kind of funny, kind of entertaining, and I think it's kind of interesting that they managed to grab the domain name. And of course, that led to some speculation on our part that if you did a quick who is on RC212V, that you might just turn up a certain address on Earl's Lane in Owensboro, Kentucky, as the registrar or registrant and administrative contact and all of that. But I don't think that really happened. So why don't we go ahead and get on with the rest of the show? We're going to start off with another visit to Kropotkin Thinks from David Emmett. And this is going to be cool stuff. I think you'll enjoy it. David Emmett over there at MotoGP Matters, writing the Kropotkin Thinks blog, was nice enough to send me a really long email about rider communication back to the pits, because I talked about that in a show or two ago and how in Formula One they do that and it makes things interesting. And David had this to say, and I think it's good stuff. David writes, one of the most absorbing parts of any Formula One broadcast is the radio feed featuring the communication between the drivers and their pit crews. It provides a fascinating insight into the strategy, tactics, and even the team politics of Formula One, and it adds an extra dimension to the show. After the race is over, the radio conversations are discussed on internet forums almost as intensely as the racing, and the popularity of the pit radio broadcast has caused some MotoGP fans to suggest that similar radio broadcasts might add more excitement to MotoGP broadcasts as well. Those MotoGP fans are wrong. Their reasoning seems sound. If the conversations between drivers and pit crews are interesting for Formula One, they'd be interesting in MotoGP as well. But they overlook one of the key reasons that the driver to pit crew conversations are so interesting in Formula One. The rest of the racing is incredibly dull. There is so little action on track that the soap opera going on behind the scenes in the chatter between drivers and their teams keeps the viewer's attention. It fills the racing void and it tells more of the story, that part of the story that isn't happening out there on the track. And the reason that there's so little happening on the track is because it's all being controlled by the teams. The engineers are carefully watching the data coming back from the cars and they're telling the drivers how to deal with it, fixing the drivers' problems before they even happen. I remember watching the warm-up lap of one of the Formula One races recently and hearing Lewis Hamilton's team tell him, "Extra braking before you get back to the grid, Lewis. Your front disc brakes aren't up to temperature yet." If Hamilton had not been told that, he would have had to have figured out for himself whether his brakes were working correctly or not, and he could have had a lot more difficulty in braking for the first corner. He would, in other words, have had to drive the car and not just operate the vehicle as instructed. The enormous popularity of Formula One has made winning absolutely imperative. Winning has become so important that it can't be left only to the driver anymore. He has a team of engineers feeding him the data that he needs to keep the car running at its optimum level of performance, and the room for error has been removed as much as possible. And this has completely killed the actual racing. It has now become incredibly difficult for a great driver to make a difference. Drivers are relying less and less on the feel of the car and more on the data that they're receiving from the pits. That may make for a pure, more technology-centric contest between car manufacturers, but it's taking the racing away from the drivers. The one feature of MotoGP that fans and detractors all agree on is that the rider can make a big difference to the outcome of a race. Having superior equipment does not automatically mean that you will win, as has been demonstrated time and time again through the years. Indeed, one of the reasons that a lot of fans oppose the use of traction control and launch control in MotoGP is that it takes control of the bike away from the rider and puts it in the hands of electronics. It means that rider skill can make less of a difference. If MotoGP starts using ship-to-shore radio, this would get infinitely worse. Engineers could monitor every aspect of the machinery, and they could tell the riders how to manage their fuel load, their tires, and their engine temperatures. Riders would no longer use up their tires in a furious fight and then have to nurse them home. They'd be given instructions on how to manage those tires, as the engineers could monitor the temperatures and probably even tire condition from the pits. They'd be told when to push and when to hold station. They'd be told four times per lap how close their pursuers are, instead of having to wait until they got to the main straightaway and hope that they have enough time to glance at the pit board that's flying by at 180 miles an hour. Winning is just as important in MotoGP as it is in Formula One. Teams do everything they can to ensure that it's their guy that's going to win. If that means taking decisions away from the rider and putting them into the hands of the pit crew, then they would do it in an instant. It wouldn't take too much. It would take much of the spectacle away from the racing, but that's not the team's responsibility. The team's responsibility is to win. If we want MotoGP to be about the skill of the rider and to keep the racing exciting, then allowing radio communication would be a bad thing. The key to keeping the racing close is allowing riders the freedom to make their own decisions and to ride the bike as they feel that they have to. Allowing onboard radios would take too much of that independence away. And I thought that was actually an excellent write-up. And David pretty much kind of convinced me that, yes, to a point, you're probably right. The nature right now of MotoGP would mean that we would lose something with that. Because you're right, it wouldn't just be somewhat simple communications back and forth from the pits. It would be, you know, basically telling the rider all of the telemetry. We kind of discussed this a little bit, David and I, and Jules chimed in, you know, with email and things. And one of the points that Jules brought up that it's, you know, it's really a cool idea, but why not have that same data that would the engineers would be seeing? Why not have that same data shown to the rider in the cockpit via, you know, instrumentation, and then let the rider deal with it to get around such a rule? Computers are getting tiny, and all the data could be collected and crunched on board the motorcycle, so you wouldn't need, you know, actual ship to shore. It would be pretty much like ship to cockpit. Information overload would be a problem initially, but fighter pilots deal with a lot more information than a motorcycle rider does, and they've learned to deal with it. Frankly, I think a guy talking on the radio while you're leaned over making an inside pass would be a lot more distracting than a readout that is changing to tell you that the temperature on the left side of your tire is exceeding the recommended amount and that sort of thing. Jules does think it's a good rule to not have ship to shore, mainly to keep the racing more personal, which he's starting to realize is also why he hates the pit stop rule, because that's where the line between the personal ride and the team ride gets messed up. Jules has a good point there as well. One thing I thought, though, is that having that much information kind of barraged at the rider in such a relatively small area as the MotoGP cockpit would probably be a little bit too much to handle. Fighter pilot analogy or whatever notwithstanding. I mean, if you've seen a Formula One steering wheel, there's buttons and lights and gauges and crap all over this thing. But the driver of a Formula One car has comparatively more time and more, you know, even though they're going faster, it's just sort of seems like to me as a motorcycle rider that it's a little bit easier to kind of pay attention to stuff like that when you're on in a car rather than on a motorcycle. Probably I might be wrong on that. I might be jumping to a false conclusion, but I still think that that having that much information and little buttons to push and things like that where you're having to take your hands off the bars, it would be a not good thing at all in MotoGP. So I don't want to see that either. I do somewhat disagree a little bit with David in the, you know, the traction control and launch control comments that he made and stuff, because I think that, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, that the technologies that can trickle down to you and I as riders should be developed. They should continue to be developed, and they should be continuing to push the edge and push the technological limits. And launch control, well, you know, maybe you don't want your average street hooligan to have launch control, but traction control is certainly a a real thing that can benefit a lot of riders in a variety of different ways. Even if you just sort of limit it to, say, like a sport touring bike, the kind of bikes that are typically equipped with ABS and all that sort of thing. If you had the traction control on there, and we're starting to see sport bikes with traction control, there's no doubt about that. And So it's a good thing. It really is. And it's not just to make you go faster, which we all know as motorcyclists is very, very important. But even from the good rule, I won't exceed the speed limit, but just to, it will make you safer. And that is kind of the important thing. Whereas better communication between you and someone else, whether they're in your house or on the motorcycle next to you or whatever, a la the chatterbox system that you see in helmets and stuff, this is half the reason why I ride a motorcycle, to get away from that. You know, here I am and I don't have to worry. The cell phone rings, I don't care. I don't even know. And the last thing I would do is answer it. I don't need to hear, you know, a bunch of chit chat from somebody else. So the only thing that would be improving technology wise if we had the ship to shore communications would be, like I said, this sort of communication back and forth to the motorcycle. And that is not something that we need, in my opinion, personally. I mean, those things are all well and good. And if you happen to go on group rides or whatever, and you have voice communication with one another and you like that, well, you know, that's fine. And that's your choice. And I guess you probably would want a better chatterbox. But personally, for me, like I said, that's one of the things that I kind of enjoy getting away from. And if I'm doing a ride with a bunch of buddies and we all decide that it's time to pull over for whatever reason, we'll tend to use hand signals, or you just kind of follow the guy when he stops, that sort of thing. And those things work just dandy fine. So I thought that was an interesting story. And again, big thanks to David Emmett for writing that up. Make sure you check out his blog. It's called Kropotkin Thinks, and you can find it at MotoGPMatters.com. He posts a lot of interesting stuff up there, and a lot of people go in there and they make the comments and all that sort of thing. Kind of turns into a mini forum. It's really good stuff. Let's talk a little bit about the Pelini Malaysian Motorcycle Grand Prix that we just had last weekend there at the Sepang track in Malaysia. And I've said this before, I'll kind of probably say it again. Sepang's not exactly one of my favorite circuits. It's one of these Herman Tilke designed Formula One behemoths. And I just don't think it makes for that great a racing. I mean, we had a good race there last year. This year's race was, frankly, a little bit of a snooze fest. But basically, what happened there, we did have some good stuff going on, some on-track action, as always. It is MotoGP, so every race is worth watching. On the grid, qualifying real quick, Danny Pedrosa, Casey Stoner, and Marco Melandri on the front row shaking things up. Randy Depunier, Anthony West, and Nicky Hayden on the second row. Chris Vermeulen, Tony Elias, and Valentino Rossi down in ninth. Not a very good qualifying position for Rossi. John Hopkins, Loris Caparossi, and Alex Barros on the fourth row. Colin Edwards, Shinya Nakano, and Sylvain Guattoli on the fifth row. Carlos Checa, Chaz Davis riding the Pramac Dantin for the fired Alex Hoffman and the not really welcome Ivan Silva, and the Makoto Tomata rounding out the sixth row there. And then on the seventh row, Nabuato Aoki, wildcard rider for Rizla Suzuki, and Curtis Roberts from Team KR. So there's our grid real quick. That was probably the quickest grid I've done all year long. And basically what happened is Casey Stoner got the whole shot ahead of Pedrosa, led into turn one, and led every lap after that and won the race. And that's pretty much about as much fun as the race was. You had Pedrosa following right behind him. Basically, you had Stoner leading from Pedrosa, Depunier, and Melandri. And this group of four started breaking away from Ant West there in fifth. And basically, they, you know, they made a couple of riding swaps or position swaps and all of that, but it just, there was some good stuff, but there wasn't that much good stuff. Some of the interesting things that did happen is poor old Anthony West had his second ride-through penalty of the season, this time for lining up in the wrong grid box. And if you'll notice, 125s and 250s line up four abreast, and the MotoGP bikes line up three abreast. So there's a lot of grid boxes painted on the startup, because you have to have, you know, the four for the smaller classes, and then the threes for the bigger classes. So basically, the guys on the outside in MotoGP will line up in the same grid box that the 125s and 250s line up in, but the guys on the inside will take one of these three. And poor old Ant West got in the wrong box somehow. And, you know, it's something, yes, he should have noticed, but it's also something that somebody else should have noticed and fixed before the flag ever went down. And unfortunately, it meant that his wheel was slightly ahead of where it would have been if he'd been in the correct grid box or whatever the actual exact reasoning was according to the rules, and they gave the guy a ride through. He was probably wondering what the hell I'm getting a ride through for, because he knew he didn't jump start for the second time this season. So that kind of spoiled Ant West's race for him. He managed to claw back a few positions and ended up finishing 15th. So, like I said, those four guys out front were pretty much out front the whole time. A little bit of a position changing back there for spots 2, 3, and 4, but I just, you know, Casey Stoner led flag to flag. Nikki Hayden didn't get off to the greatest of starts and was really pushing it hard and trying to make better on his initial thing, and unfortunately ran off track in the final hairpin when he was trying to outbreak Tony Elias on lap 13 there. So in that dropped him way down the order. He managed to get all the way back up to 9th. So rather than jumping around all over the place, why don't we see and just go down the list here. First place was Casey Stoner. Like I said, 10th win of the season. Doing fantastic still, and wouldn't be too surprised to see him win in Valencia, which is probably going to be a better race than Malaysia was. Number two, Marco Melandri, our random number generator for the season, taking a podium there. It's kind of good stuff. See Marco Melandri up there. Like I said, the guy's got a lot of talent, and he's a force to be reckoned with. Danny Pedrosa managed to bring it home in third, rounding out the podium there. Top Michelin rider. Randy DePugne in fourth spot in the Kawasaki. Not a bad result for Kawasaki. Valentino Rossi got up to fifth after a fairly non-impressive 9th on the grid, which he actually dropped all the way down to 11th after his start. So he, you know, did quite a bit of passing there. Most of our passing, as usual, done by Rossi. Sixth spot went to Tony Elias. Seventh spot, Chris Vermeulen, who was involved in a huge race-long battle with teammate John Hopkins. The two Suzukis racing each other pretty hard, and that was probably some of the best racing we had going on. So they finished 7th and 8th. Ninth spot went to Nikki Hayden, who, like I said, had run off track. So he could have had a bit better race. He felt that his pace was really good by and large, and it sort of warranted more than the 9th that he finished. So he's feeling confident, and hopefully in Valencia he'll be able to put on a really good show and show us what he's capable of, because we know he is capable of more. He's had just a truly disastrous season in one variety or another. 10th spot went to Colin Edwards. 11th spot, Loris Caparossi. 12th, Alex Barros. 13th, Nobuo Aoki, doing a pretty good performance there for a wild card, picking up 3 championship points. 14th spot went down to Carlos Checa, and 15th, Anthony West, who would have done a whole lot better had he not had that ride-through penalty. 16th spot, Shinya Nakano. 17th, Chaz Davis on the Pramac Dentine. Not doing too badly there, considering, you know, new to MotoGP and all that good stuff. I think he's still impressing people. So 18th, Makoto Tomata. 19th, Sylvain Guintoli. And 20th, Curtis Roberts. Another interesting thing about the Malaysian Grand Prix, no retirements, no crashes. So although we had a couple of off-track excursions and Rossi did some interesting kicking up of dust and all that sort of thing, nobody actually crashed. So that's kind of good that everybody finished the race. So, but other than that, I can't say that the Malaysian Grand Prix of 2007 is one that I'm going to look back on and say, wow, what a race. Hey, you know, like we've had some of those this season. We certainly have, but Malaysia was not one of them. So moving on, why don't we talk to Jules and Liam? All right, we got Liam and Jules on the phone today. We're doing a big old conference call. I think this is the first time I've done a three-way with MotoGPOD, and that sounds pretty scary, but it's working out pretty good. Got a great connection with Liam, and we got Jules. So hi, guys. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Hey, everybody. Hey, Jules. Hey, Bob. Hey, everyone out there in MotoGPOD land.
Howdy, howdy.
So we were talking a little bit in our pre-call chit-chatty thing that turned into about a 20-minute conversation about what we want to talk about. And some of the stuff we want to talk about is the riders and what's going on there. So, Jules, you kind of had some sort of cedar stuff. Let's throw it out there.
Yeah, my first question is, you know, Barros is leaving. How does the team feel you guys did with Alex Barros on the team?
You know, it's a little like we didn't perform to expectations. I think we all came into the season with a little bit bigger expectations, and after 17 races, I think there were a couple opportunities where we could have done better. And, you know, after watching him, because I've known him since 2005 and saw him when he was in Superbike briefly and just always had a good relationship with him that we could talk about anything. Or, you know, we went out drinking in Prague after the race, you know, just have a good connection with the guy. It's pretty obvious that he's been on the GP Tour for more than 20 years, it seems, or thereabouts. And it takes a toll on you. So I think now's a fitting time for him to kind of lay it down a little bit and just go back and hang out on the beach with his young girlfriend and kind of smell the roses a bit, because he has been on the road for a long time. It's kind of mind-boggling when you think about how much he's actually been in airplanes and hotel rooms and everything else, everything but his house, for the last 20 years, near 20 years.
Yeah,
sure. Definitely.
But it's a strange feeling, though, to work with someone where you know that their career is coming to an end. You know, you think, well, did I contribute to that? Did, you know, if he'd done better, would he have been back for another year? You ask yourself these questions, but, you know, looking back, I know that I always did my best and the people around me did their best. So we held up our side of things. And once the green light goes, it's time for them to do their thing. Still, it is going to be kind of odd, and I will be sad at Valencia, not just because, you know, it's his last race, looking like his last race in MotoGP and in world competition, and also because I know some of the guys on the team are leaving. A couple of the younger guys have said that they want to start normal lives and have girlfriends and wives and regular jobs and, you know, start building towards a material-type future, which for me, at this point, is not really feasible. Like, it's the last thing on my mind to think, oh, okay, next year I want to buy a house, or I can't wait, there's this car that I've really got my eye on. it's pretty far out thinking at this point. I've been through such a shift. Of course, I was never really good with planning anyway. And that's kind of how I ended up here.
That's why you're the planning guy.
Yeah, at this point. But that's, you know, that follows my autism of sorts, my modus savantness. That if it's bike related, I can totally think about it.
Right. No, it's a focus issue. This is what you decided to focus on, and I think it's awesome.
Well, it just happened. Just for riders leaving, let's see. We probably had Shinichi Ito's last race in MotoGP. We've been through Ivan Silva's last races in MotoGP. Alex Hoffman's not looking to come back into MotoGP. And who knows what the future holds for Chaz Davies. You know, he's going back to AMA for a year and probably a couple of years.
So who's riding in Valencia?
No, he'll be there. Chaz will be there.
Okay.
But for next year, he's looking to either go to Pat Kawasaki or Arian Honda.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you think Hoffman's going anywhere? I mean, does he have any leads for anything?
Yeah, he just finished a test at Valencia a few days ago, working on a project for 2009 in World Superbike. So
cool.
I think his future is looking all right.
Well, that's good news cool. for him, at least, yeah.
Yeah, I can't tell you which manufacturer it is, but apparently he's riding a beast.
Cool. Well, that's good. Yeah, so.
Now, the guys coming in, this morning I read that Tony Elias is now confirmed.
Yeah.
That's going to be really fun.
Press release a while ago, and I expected it to be announced sooner, to be honest with you, but there was some behind-the-scenes things that were going on, and I think it took a little while to shake out all the contracts and everything. But he is confirmed, and I think his riding style is going to be quite interesting. I don't know if it's going to mesh really well with this bike, but there are some changes for the GP8, so I hope that they work well with him. His riding style is pretty unique.
Definitely.
Safe to say that he's going to do better on specialized tires rather than on a control tire.
Yeah, I know exactly. And then you've you've known him before? You've talked to him before? I remember you mentioned he's a cool guy to work with.
We spent some time talking because we both fly out of Barcelona, so I've seen him on a couple of flights and just hung out in the airports during our stopovers and or on our way home. And he's always smiling and got a good attitude, even when things weren't really going well for him in the season or when he got really hurt this year. I don't think a lot of people took into account how serious a break that was and how much effort it takes to ride one of these bikes.
Well, that was a painful thing to see.
Yeah. It's interesting. I thought a lot of people have mentioned that, some of the people I know that are trainers or close to other riders, they say when they get into GP, all of a sudden they get all these muscles. And I don't think people realize how much effort it takes to stop one of these things. your whole body is being used. The people that can ride with broken ribs just amaze me. But just in 1 year, Sylvan riding the M1, we hung out at the pool in Malaysia last week, and he's pretty strong at this point. Much more, the GP guys are a lot more fit, I would say, than the 250 guys, even the ones that exercise regularly. And it just comes from riding the bike. So... I think it was kind of shocking for Chaz at Laguna and then a little bit again in Phillip Island and then in Malaysia, just how much effort it takes to ride one of these things.
Wow. And Chaz is a big guy.
Yeah, Chaz is big but thin.
That's true. Yeah, I remember seeing him in the Hoffman letters. He looked like he didn't really fill them out all that well.
Yeah, he doesn't quite fill them out the same way. Anyway, Sylvan's coming. Elias is coming, Tony. So that's going to be a fun year. Both have exciting styles. I think when you look at any of the photos of Gintley, if you look carefully and you held them side by side with a photo of Rossi in the same corner, the body positioning is very, very similar. It's kind of creepy, actually, that they both, physically, they're about the same size, and they both learned to ride this bike the same way. The only difference, and this is the most striking difference, is that Rossi looks at the ground.
Right.
And Elias looks through the corner. I mean, Gintley looks through the corner.
Yeah.
But data-wise, his data person from Tech3 has mentioned how similar their styles are and that the data confirms that. So
that's really interesting, considering that they're on a different tire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting.
But, it's still riding the same bike.
Yeah.
So if you got to lean it a certain way or manhandle in a certain way, he's definitely got that down. It'll be fun to see what he does with Bridgestone.
He's been very surprising, though, the whole year. He's pulled out a couple of interesting surprises, so I think he's going to be a great guy to have on the team.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we can keep both guys in the top 10. If things stand the way they are now, this will be my first year finishing within the top 10 with Alex Burrows. We're a little bit too far behind Nicky Hayden to kind of catch up to him, but you never know. Valencia's brought out some surprises in the past.
Totally.
Yeah, 13 points in one race. I mean, if Hayden has another one of his disasters and Burrows has a good race, that's actually, doable. But you never know.
It's weird because you don't want to root against the champ.
No, of course not.
Like, on a personal level, I don't want to see Nicky Hayden fail. I was bummed out every time he's had a bad race or broke down at Phillip Island. I think we were robbed of a really good race there because he seemed like he was the only one that had what it took to stick with Casey.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I agree. I never like to really sort of root against anybody unless it's Matt Mladen. And just to I don't like to see... when somebody has to lose, of course, but it's not like, oh, but that guy's got to lose so my guy can win. I that's sort of
right.
Negative rooting. I don't like that.
I just want to see a good race.
Bingo. Exactly. That's what I like to
see. And naturally, I want my guy to do well.
Sure.
But I'd like to see a good race.
Yeah. So what do you...
Let's see. We've rushed on to Stoner, so congratulations to the world champ and Ducati Corsa. That's quite an amazing feat they pulled off this year. I'm sure we'll cover that in a future episode.
Yes, definitely well earned. I actually got a really interesting email about the whole thing with about the 30 years odd that it's been since a European manufacturer won the thing.
33.
And the Yeah, and the and the differences between now and then of what we're doing. And I'm actually looking for this email, and probably should have found this before the call, but I just remembered it. So let me see if I can find it.
It would have been Phil Reed on the MV Agusta.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it does. And
I think that was before I was born, but we're going to go with that.
Oh, here it is. Here it is.
How
here
crazy
we go.
Is that, dude? That's amazing, huh?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
This is from Gary Shavit in Israel, and he says, think what the world was like the last time the champion was won on a non-Japanese motorcycle. He says there were no cell phones. The closest were some rich people that had phones in their cars, you know, when there was like a freaking big old AT&T right. phone, you know. No podcasts, of course, because there was no home computers, no iPods. You know, Walkman were just barely kind of getting going. Actually, I'm not even sure about that in 74. I don't think so. You had little transistor radios. No satellite TV. You did have cable some places, but it wasn't very common. All motorsport news came from special interest monthlies with maybe a few minutes on a network sports show that was delayed at least a week. On the other hand...
That sounds like today, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. On the other hand, he says there was fighting in the Middle East, gas prices were soaring, and Castro was president of Cuba. But I, you know, I thought it was kind of funny. I mean, it's a long time,
That's
33
great.
Years. Yeah. But in any case,
makes you think.
It does. Makes you think a little bit. And I mean, Ducati, and you're no small part of that, Liam. With you know, even though you. It is the factory team and all that, but I mean this is a cool thing that they've done. I mean, they haven't even been back in GP all that long, and now they've come out of the gate swinging. So
yeah, it's amazing to think they had a short season in 2003 with their surprise win in Catalonia, and then just a couple years later they were in contention to win last year, which I think people are overlooking quite a bit. You know, when history looks back, they'll see that Caparazzi finished third, barely in front of Melandri. But they won't see that, wow, up until Catalonia, he was right in the hunt. But yeah. Even by the end of the season, he only finished, 25 points back. That's a race when he had to race three different races injured and missed out on the Catalonia race. So could have been his year last year. But let's see. Let's quote the world champion. If ifs and buts were sugar and nuts, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, we yeah those sayings. If your aunt had balls, she'd be your uncle. You know, that kind of thing.
What?
Okay, you never heard that one? If your aunt had balls, she'd be your uncle.
let's stick to motorcycles.
Nicky Hayden said it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, yes, he did. I remember that. Yeah, exactly. I was trying to remember the thing. He needed to say something along those lines. Yeah.
So I guess that leads me into. Since we're talking about Nicky Hayden's championship, and we're going to talk about Valentino Rossi not having a good feeling with Michelin in the Valencia race and struggling with them this year, notably in a couple races. Other races, Michelin looked really good, but for the most part, it was a Bridgestone year. And the vibe in the paddock is that Rossi will go to Bridgestone and tire limits will be increased from 31 tires per weekend to 40.
And there's also talk about not having to actually pick the tire until after the first practice, right? Or something like that?
Yeah. That's going to be good, but it's also going to throw a monkey wrench into the time schedule thing because those meetings take a little while to go through. And if you lose your chief during that time, that means the data guy and everyone else have to be that much more clear at the end of the session so that they know which direction to change the bike for free practice too. So... it'll have small complications, but nothing that we can't deal with. I would say the most important thing is that we get a better sense for how far off the ball people are going to be. Because if you pick a different bunch of families and compounds on Thursday, things could be very different on Sunday. But, honestly, if we're picking all the tires on Friday after the first session, it could still be really different on Sunday. We had two races in particular this year where Friday and Saturday were one type of weather condition, and then you had to throw all your setup stuff out because the race was completely different.
Right. Right.
So
yeah. It does help.
It's still kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah, and it'll definitely help in situations like where you've had a track that was just resurfaced or something and you have no data.
Yeah.
So, it's a start.
Yeah, it is a step in the right way.
You guys are confirmed with Bridgestone, right?
What's that? We're not concerned with it?
No, you're confirmed. You're confirmed that you're on Bridgestones.
No, I don't know, to be honest with you. But I can't logically see a way where we would not use Bridgestone, because I think it's part of our package deal that we're getting GP8s next year and we'll run the same tires.
Got it.
Because our data has been pretty important for the factory this year, and we're still testing solutions and working on things on this year's bike, and we'll continue to do so next year on next year's Evolution.
So Tectoire is going to Michelin, which means where is Dunlop going? I mean, this tire rule is kind of to help Dunlop catch up, and you know.
Well, what are they going to reduce costs, because we're still going to have to bring so much material over previously, and everybody, it just seemed to be an escalating thing. You know, if you could use 5 tires in a session, or how many times do you want to come in to change tires each session? How many tires do you have? Well, let's use them all. And it kind of was getting ridiculous. When I look at the tire guys this year compared to what I was doing last year, it's a lot easier this year.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, a lot less wheels and everything to clean.
Do you know, like, has there been any rumor in the paddock about is Dunlop done, or are they going to go to KR, or what's up?
Yeah, the consensus has been that Dunlop is done for a bunch of races now.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible that they pay somebody to use their tires, but honestly, I can't see it happening at this point. I'd like to, but I can't think of who it would be.
Yeah.
The thought process was that it might go to LCR. It might go to LCR. Run with the Honda, but I haven't heard anything about that in weeks.
Just one bike, huh?
Yeah.
Hmm.
But these decisions are things that haven't even totally been finalized yet, right? I mean, there's something
right.
could
we
be pulled
exactly
out.
We don't exactly know what it's going to be.
Right.
Though Carmelo did rescind the mono tire proposal.
Sure.
So that's a good thing.
He was only joking. Hmm.
No, seriously, that's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
It's like, it was just a joke. Actually, I mean, it might have been just a political move to get the tire companies off their ass to do something, but I don't know. It started looking like it was the real
what
deal
there
for
done?
A while.
Honestly, I mean, if the rules were the same for next season that they were this season, do you think Michelin would take it lying down? Like, oh, man, we got our asses handed to us last year. Let's just do the same thing for 2008. Of course, they're working hard back in the labs. I can't think of a more... Let's see. Egotistical is the word I'm thinking of, but they're French, so maybe I'll say it's passionate. If you know anything about the culture and the food and all the rest of it, then you'll get what I'm saying. If you don't know anything about it, you're going to think I'm being a jerk. But
I know a lot.
Yeah. So let's just say that Michelin is not going to take it lying down. They've increased their budget allegedly by 30% for next season. They should have some of their F1 dudes working on it back in the lab coats. And it'll be time to see if Bridgestone can do a repeat. You know, no one's handed a defeat like this to Michelin in 15, 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be fun to see what they come up with.
Sure. Yeah, I think
definitely it's going to be an interesting thing in the Yamaha garage if Rossi does go to Bridgestone and Lorenzo is on Michelin's. Sparks will fly. It's going to be great.
Right. Wouldn't that also make it logistically a freaking nightmare for that team, or would it not be that big a deal?
Well, see, the Pons did it.
I don't think it's going to. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be too big of a deal. No, in Pons they did separate both halves of the garage with paneling.
They did actually. That's true.
Yeah.
They physically separated them.
What I had heard was that Lorenzo contractually was promised the exact same equipment as Rossi. So there might be an issue there somewhere in the fine print that says, oh, I have to have the same tires, but Bridgestone can't supply the same tires, and so on and so forth. So these are all backroom deals with the real big heavy hitters. And I won't know anything about it until I read it on the internet like you guys.
When we had a conversation with a listener, John Kelly, a few days ago, And he was saying, you know, if Michelin does crank up the budget and they come up with the better tires next year and Rossi goes to Bridgestone, you know, isn't it kind of like a knee-jerk reaction and whatever? It seems like that's actually, that rumor is getting some legs, that he is going to
Bridgestone. Yeah, well, people don't seem to realize how Rossi felt after Valencia last year.
Yeah, 2006, yes.
Yeah, I think a lot of people overlooked his statements that, you know, I was having a great weekend. I was ahead in the points. I was fast on Friday and Saturday. And then on Sunday, mysteriously, you know, I had a really bad warm-up. Nothing felt the same. Then I went out in the race, and I can't explain why I crashed. Because arguably we're talking about the guy that's got the best feel on tires of anybody in the paddock, and that's why he races so well. He's able to ride brand new tires. He's able to ride wasted tires at the end of the race. This is a guy that knows what he's doing. And if he said something was different on Sunday, then something was different. It's clear. I don't think a lot of the talk and smack talking that I read on the internet about him choking is feasible.
No way.
This is a guy that loves to take it right to the limit. You know, if he shadowed somebody and decided to take off at three laps left, or two laps left and make his pass, then we know he has the skill to take off at the beginning of the race like Stoner did and just walk away from everybody. But he preferred to shadow and then pass towards the end. You know, it's a different style, a different technique, but we know he's got the ability to just walk away from anybody, or he did in those years. And I don't think it's realistic to think that he totally dropped the ball because of nerves in Valencia, especially not after he made up 50-some-odd points in the last races after Laguna. This is not a guy that was just, I'm just going to go out and have fun. Championship is not on my mind. I'm just out there to win races and have a good time. And then you come into the last race ready to take the crown, and it's like, ooh, I just dropped the ball on Sunday. It doesn't compute to me.
No way.
So in that vein of thinking, you know, I don't think he has a big problem leaving Michelin, and I think it'll be for the best. If he could win on a substandard Bridgestone next year and beat the superior Michelins, that's, like Bayless said, that's just one step closer to God, like when he went over to Yamaha and beat the Hondas.
I was just going to say, like he would be able to prove it twice.
Yeah. I kind of expected him to go to Bridgestone sooner, but he ran Michelin this year.
Interesting. What about Pedrosa? Is that one a done deal that he's not getting him, or what? Have you heard anything more on that? Because, he wanted Bridgestone. Yeah.
I think there was a pretty big knee-jerk reaction. And part of it makes sense. You've got two factories, Honda and Yamaha. Honda specifically, that spends oodles of money and supplies six bikes on the grid. So that's a huge, huge investment. And if they have paid for riders that can win races, that have the talent and the skill, and they've paid to develop a machine that can win races, and they're let down by one component, the tires, you know, then they've kind of got a reason to be a little bit upset. But in the grand scheme of things, I think them wanting to switch immediately, it is a little bit premature because, you know, no one has given Michelin a year to kind of get their feedback. I think a major team switching brands like that after just 1 year is too fast.
Not to mention that, like, it's the bike might not react to the new different kind of tire immediately. Although they do have data from Grassini.
Absolutely.
I think Yamaha is the one that's taking a bigger risk if they're going to run one Bridgestone bike and three Michelin bikes.
Well, their chassis really allows them to exploit grip.
Oh, yeah.
The term is, that's a really grippy chassis that they've got. And when the grip is too much, that's when you end up with chatter problems. And I mean, the bike is right on the line as far as being too grippy and not grippy enough. It is a sensitive chassis. I think with the increased abilities that the front will give Rossi, if they can find a good balance in the preseason, then he's going to be deadly right from the get-go. I don't think people realize what a big thing it is to switch tire manufacturers, because you build your bike in conjunction with the tires that you're given. You build next year's bike based on what you're using now. It's significant.
Yeah.
We'll put it that way. It's significant. I don't think the Kawasaki would be as fast if they were using second-tier Michelins this whole time, but they've had access to first-tier Bridgestones and personalized development for their bike, and now their bike is hauling ass. I've maintained throughout this season that after Le Mans, they've had something under the hood, but they've really got a good bike.
I think you've said that even before the season started. You said that they may actually have the best bike on the grid.
Yeah, I think, well, I see when they pull out a new chassis and a new swing arm and all the rest of it, and it's like, wow, they're really pushing. At the Brno test, they had engine parts, chassis, swing arms. I mean, they tested a full gamut of stuff. So they're not just sitting around. They're waiting to take it to the next level. And when they get Hopkins next year, they're going to go for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so next subject.
Next subject. What do we have on our list, Jules? Just moving it along here.
So you got one round left, and you're going to have Chad Davies riding at the track at Valencia, right?
You're going to have
Barros, and it's a track where the Ducati did extremely well last year. Of course, it's a different kind of Ducati, but you know, what do you think?
Well, I think anybody would be a fool to kind of bet against Stoner at this point, because he's riding on a totally different level.
Yeah.
I don't even know if his eyes are open when he's riding the bike.
Feel the force, Casey.
he's just out there. The kid is on. And, I didn't really expect the Ducatis to do as well as they did last year there, because it's a strange circuit. I've never been able to get that circuit, really. When playing video games and whatnot, it just always feels like a strange circuit. Same with Catalunya. It doesn't seem to reward massive horsepower. It's got that one long straight, but then the rest of it is all these strange little corners that seem to come up too fast. So I honestly didn't expect Ducati to do so well last year, but they did. And Stoner's proven this year that at tracks where we thought the Ducati wasn't going to go good, he just went out and stomped everybody, or he had a fantastic battle with Rossi and won more often than not. I think they're going to do all right. But I think everybody is kind of...
You guys, specifically?
We're shooting for top 10s, definitely. If Barros has another good weekend where he's around top 5 through the practices and qualifying, I'm going to be really happy. We did come off our best qualifying result in Phillip Island most recently, so that bodes well.
Yep.
And I think he wants to finish strong.
He has a good history at Valencia.
Yeah. And he's, this is it,
Yeah. This is right.
Yeah.
Sure. And, even though the race is a bit of a somewhat of a lame duck as far as the championship, and we've heard, sort of complaints about that kind of thing, just grumbling that it's not going down to the wire, I think each race should be taken as a standalone thing as well. And, nice thing about motorcycle. Yeah, that's not always the nice thing about motorcycle racing, that each race is exciting. You don't have to be following the championship just to sort of figure out what the hell's going on like you do with Formula One.
Yeah, personally, for me, each race is individual. Then you add up all those individuals and you come up with a champion. But each race is beautiful. Each race has its own story behind it. It was magnificent last year with the Ducati 1-2.
Yeah.
But I think it would have been great for any manufacturer to have a 1-2 at Valencia that time, or any time.
But specifically, it was also Bayless, the fact that he came in for a one-off and just took off.
Yeah, he came in riding high off the Superbike Championship, and it goes to prove another thought that I've mentioned before, that you cannot put a price on rider confidence. It's key to the equation, and it's something that I think the paddock, or just in general, if you want to be successful in racing as a chief mechanic or you know, a leader, you should have some kind of psychology lessons, or maybe not psychology specifically, like you're going to go in there and hypnotize somebody, or, you know, ask them if their mother and father gave them hugs, or, you know, none of that mumbo jumbo, but just, you know, understand your writer, have a way of understanding your writer and making them feel comfortable and at ease, and then everything falls into place, because when the writer's feeling good, that's when things start to happen.
And speaking of I actually we need to wrap it up, but I have one question I've been dying to ask you. So you're friends with Hiro, and he did he's coming off a great weekend at Sepang, obviously, because he won the race. And what is his future looking like?
He's going to continue with KTM for one more season.
Okay.
He's signed up to ride alongside Kaleo once again and push that development even further. He's doing good. I mean, he explored some options in MotoGP, and maybe they didn't feel right for whatever reason. I can't really talk about the specifics.
Sure.
I'm happy for him because he's in a good place with a strong factory team, and they're constantly pushing. I mean, they started this year with the bike really struggling, but you saw in Sepang how fast they were despite the two really long straights. I mean, those bikes were right in the mix.
Yeah.
Through the practices and qualifying. So they've obviously taken steps forward, and I think they need to be there with strong riders. KTM needs to be there, because otherwise it would be the Aprilia Cup, because the Honda really hasn't been making any steps forward development-wise with their two-stroke programs.
Agreed.
I think one guy to watch next year will definitely be Dovizioso, because he's proven what he can do on an underpowered bike in 250 and challenge for wins. And he's definitely going to be hungry to show what he's capable of once he gets a GP bike under him.
Yeah, but unfortunately he's on the wrong bike, on the wrong team.
You think?
Well, it's Team Scott now, right? It's not Konica. It's a different management, I believe, right?
Well, his Scott team's coming with him.
Yeah.
And I think it's emerging with JIR, Japan International Racing. But I think predominantly he'll be surrounded by the same guys he knew. And Scott, you know, a couple of guys taken out, but I think he's going to be all right. I say this because Honda stated that next year's factory bikes were going to be very different than what the customer bikes were going to be. And the customer bikes were basically going to be evolutions of what the current factory bike is. And if the current factory bike is any indication, I mean, Pedrosa and Hayden have really fast bikes at this point. I think the evolution next year for almost all the manufacturers is going to be electronic
valves
and increased fuel efficiency. But I don't think we're going to see a massive step forward in horsepower or top speed.
Are we going to see pneumatic valves in Hondas, you think?
It's possible. I read something recently that they're running two different types of engines right now, a pneumatic engine and a desmodromic engine.
Right. Yeah, right.
Something online about that.
I think if they went to the Desmo, though, man, that would be like the ultimate, you know, admission of defeat.
I don't know. They have a history of taking technology, miniaturizing it, and making it better.
Exactly. And that's also Honda has. I mean, I don't think there would be so much admitting defeat as just as showing adaptability. Perhaps is a way to put it. You know, take the battle to the other guy.
If they came out with a magic engine in just one season. You know, or less than one season. If they said in March, holy smokes, get on that design right now, and next year they came out with, you know, a barn busting super bike that just annihilated everybody, that would be quite an engineering feat in itself. I'm curious, and I'm sure Ducati is too.
Well, I'll bet. Well, it's been a good one. It's been a nice call and nice chatting with you guys here, but it is time to kind of wrap it up. Now it's time to say goodbye to friends and family. And
happy Halloween, everybody.
Yes, happy Halloween. Yes, exactly. So thanks a lot for the time on the call, Liam. It's always great to talk to you over there in Spain. And Jules, thanks for, you know, kind of putting it together and hosting the conference call and all of that. And we'll talk to everybody real soon.
Ciao.
Ciao. See you, everybody.
And that's going to do it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. We have a weekend off from MotoGP action. They'll come back for November 4th for the Valencia round, the final round of the season there. And it should be some good racing going on. Not 100% sure how the whole daylight savings time switch and all that business is going to exactly affect our times. So sort of stay tuned, and I will figure that out for our preview show that we'll have next week. Talk a little bit about Valencia so that you know what time to go to MotoGP.com. Or tune into Speed or Eurosport or however it is that you watch our chosen sport. Everybody else seems to be pretty much done. Formula One, World Superbikes, they've all finished their seasons. And speaking of Formula One, if you hadn't had a chance to see their last race of the season that they had in Brazil, if you're at all a Formula One fan, it's pretty worth watching. Non-Formula One fans, I think, you know, it's hard to sort of get involved with Formula One as a standalone race. It's not like motorcycle racing where each race is its own exciting thing. Formula One, you sort of have to be kind of a fan of the whole thing because so much of it is pit strategy and championship strategy and all that. But as close as Formula One ever gets to an edge of the seat race they had in Brazil, it was kind of neat stuff. So read up on it or see if you can find it somewhere on the internet or with a friend or something. I don't know if you're a fan at all, because it was worth watching. It was kind of a lot of fun. Other than that, that's going to just about do it for everything. Special thanks again to David Emmett for his help and to Liam Schubert and Jules Cizik, as always, for their help. And you know, had a great fun on that conference call. Why don't you make sure you go and check out David Emmett's blog at MotoGPMatters.com. Check out RideOn2.com, which is a blog and forum and all of that, for which Jules Cizik is one of the big moderators, along with Jim Race and Jules from New Zealand and a couple other people. And, of course, always check out Liam Schubert's blog at MotoLiam.com, because that's super interesting stuff, too, as we read about Liam's wild ride through becoming a employee of a MotoGP racing team, kind of living the dream in a slightly smaller sense than say Nicky Hayden. And I'm not knocking Liam when I say that, but this is the kind of thing that is attainable for your average person that can do. And Liam has put a lot of hard work into it, and it's super interesting to be able to talk to him and hear about his latest sort of experiences and adventures and whatnot that's going on, as he just packed up all his junk and from California and moved to Spain to get a job with a MotoGP team. And it's really working out well for him, and we're so happy for him over there. It's really cool stuff. So it's going to do it for today. Thank you very much for downloading the show. Thanks for all of your emails congratulating me for the 100th episode. I think I answered them all. If I missed yours, I apologize. And believe me, I read it and I appreciated it a lot. And other than that, I think we're out, and I'll talk to you next week. One thing that you can always count on about MotoGPOD is that there will be the little disclaimer at the end, and that I'll try to make it slightly less boring by maybe trying to make it funny. Whether or not it's funny is entirely up to the listener. However, please bear with me when I tell you that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD.com is not affiliated with any of them. I actually threw in another extra .com. I was just going to say MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them, but because I'm sort of reading this and rambling on and on, got .com kind of thrown in there. So this you could listen to over and over again if you wanted to go to sleep, because it's a little bit of lawyerese that we throw in here at the end of the show to say that MotoGPOD is produced by me and that Dorna doesn't sort of even acknowledge my existence.